That sounds sick. Your bell sounds a little ill.
Well, it's not from overuse, Scott. It's not from too much ringing. It's a sad day in bell country.
You know, we're trying to prioritize things, and the TRN store just... It's time to shut the doors. It's time to close the doors on the TRN store.
It's not because the gear isn't awesome, because it is. It is awesome.
It is.
But one of us has to be inside there at the counter.
We have to open it. We have to close it. There has to be people manning the store, and we just don't have the time.
But you benefit from this because we're here to liquidate. Scott?
Liquidation sale. We have buffs. We have arm sleeves. We have reversible beanies.
And hats. And to make it simple, Scott, everything the same price.
$10.
Not for everything, $10. $10 isn't by the store.
$10 each.
$10 for a hat, $10 for arm sleeves, $10 for buffs, and $10 for the reversible beanie, and all of them top high quality. Almost sad to see it go.
It's coming up on gift-giving season. It's coming up on the fall season where you're getting a little chilly outside. So these are perfect gifts.
I think it's a gift from us to you. For listening all these years, we would like to extend a $10 gift to you.
So go to the store at Trail Runner Nation, and you can see the reduced prices. Take advantage of them. Send them to a friend. What a great way to say thank you for someone that paced you or crewed for you.
Or it's just rooting for you. Go and thank them with a stocking stuffer or just wear it. Let them see you in it. Let them become envious and then surprise them with their own.
If your hat is stinky, time to get a new one.
Okay, either we hung up or we're recording.
It's unbelievable the gold that we've just missed because Don was afraid to hit record because he's not prepped for the damn
We probably had
podcast.
enough great material in the last 5 minutes pre-podcast
to make two podcasts.
Yeah.
At the very least, that was great bumper material, and Don is just asleep at the switch today.
I wasn't asleep. I was giving respect to our listeners because they didn't want to hear that rambling.
Hey,
our listeners live for the rambling.
Hey, thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott Warr.
We have our Southern California correspondent. Introduce yourself, Jimmy.
I'm Jimmy. Dean Freeman.
And I am in no relation, Don Freeman.
Well, you're a trail brother.
We're trail brothers from different mothers, and we established that on a long run. We have, Jimmy, you came up with this topic today. Let's have you roll it out.
What's the title, Jimmy?
The plethora of ways to screw up your goal race.
Scott, can you fit that on the title line?
I'll hashtag it.
There might be 7 ways. There might be 10 ways. Don has no idea how many ways he has. I've got at least 5. Scott's got
none.
I'm working on mine.
And I've got 4 in front of me, so we'll get at least 10 out somehow.
But as always, we like to make a game of these podcasts. So how are we gamifying this?
Gamifying. Jimmy Dean, you want to throw yours out there? Or you want me to toss my idea out?
Well, when we figure out how many ways to fail that the three of us have collectively experienced, you, Trail Runner Nation listeners, will assess your quality of failure experience by either identifying with something that we've said or saying, no, I was never dumb enough to do that.
Not yet, anyway.
The more times you've associated with one of our discussed failures, the higher your grade, the higher level of expertise you have achieved in
so,
our...
So as Jimmy was explaining before we hit the red record button, we learn more from our failures than we do our finishes in many cases. And so this is one way that you can take those DNFs and actually chalk them up. And the more DNFs, the better.
The more mistakes...
I assert you learn one thing from finishing, that you can finish.
Hey, and it doesn't have to be a DNF, Scott, because you can go out there, finish a race, but totally miss something and do something that you suffered through mightily to get this thing done. So if you catch most of them, all of them, you are an expert. That means you've done it enough and you've screwed up enough to have done many of these things. So welcome, brothers and sisters, to the expert club if you score high in this I screwed this
up. And the common thread of this is you've had to try it. You had to try to fail. You had to try to finish. So the more tries, the better.
Well, and ultra running is a sport with the highest risk of failure in the running realm. Yes. You run a 5K, you might fail to run a PR, but you're not. Very few people are DNFing 5Ks. Even a marathon has a 99%+ finishing percentage among people who actually did the training. So it's not until you get into the 50-kilometer mountain race, 50-mile, 100-mile genre that you start to see the success and failure rate of finishing that event drop to 80, 70, 60, sometimes even 50% and below. So, you know, I like to go back to one of my favorite ultra running and life quotes from famous ultra runner Mark Twain.
One of the original. Gordy thought he was first, right?
Yeah. Mark Twain once said, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment.
That's it. That is a good quote.
If you can get that on, it's a subtitle, Scott. I'd recommend that.
No, that's a hashtag.
All right, Jimmy, since you've screwed up more than any of us, let's have you start this thing off.
I do want to say just a little point out is if you're following along in your Trail Runner Nation guide, we want to turn to page 53, which is inspired. Hang on, I'm going to get it. Don't tell me, Jimmy. Hang on. It is inspiredrunning.blogspot.com, which is Jimmy's blog. And it is the most read article that Jimmy ever wrote on this blog back in 2015.
The blog post is 5 reasons people DNF at the Javelina 100 miler and how to avoid it. And this podcast came up because SoCal Coyotes, we have a few runners that are running Javelina this year. I've got a couple of individual clients. One is doing Rio del Lago, which is the weekend after Javelina. And both of these events I know are important to many Trail Runner Nation listeners as they are the final two qualifiers for the Western States 100 lottery. So we're here to help you not throw away one to however many tickets that you have on the line if you have not yet qualified for the Western States lottery.
So, Jimmy, let's start off. You tell us one thing that you have experienced that has thrown your race on its side when you're supposed to be running upright.
Underestimating a course and or the distance. So, you know, all 100 milers are not created equal. All races are not created equal. Sometimes we look at an elevation profile or the altitude of a given race, and they're daunting. You know, Hard Rock, Cascade Crest, Angela's Crest, anything with crest in it, apparently.
Toothpaste?
Wasatch. Crest. When we look at these elevation profiles, the amount of net ascent and the average elevation, Leadville is another example with the elevation. You know, when we go to another event like a Javelina or, you know, Rio del Lago is probably on the lower end of the net elevation gain. When we look at those, we start to use terms like this is an easier 100 or this is an easy 100 or this is a beginner's 100. I've heard those things said about both Javelina and Rio del Lago. It's real dangerous as an experienced 100 miler to go into a race thinking it's going to be easier than others. I think of specifically Rio del Lago, Javelina, and Vermont, which are probably the three flattest. I did Rocky Raccoon as well. So I've done most of the fastest, flattest 100 miles that have been around for a while. And I'll tell you, when there's no logical place to do a walk break, when you can run the entire course, it is very easy to get in over your head, effort-wise and pace-wise. And I can't remember two races where I've experienced more pain in the last you know, third of the race than Vermont and Rocky Raccoon and Javelina, because you can run so much of it, you're going to dig yourself a big hole. So 100 miles is 100 miles. It doesn't matter how much climbing and descending you have, or how flat and fast the times people do there. If you underestimate that that course, that distance, it will bite you in the quadriceps.
Jimmy and Don, do you think that you can underestimate a course that you've run previously?
For sure.
So you've run it, you've completed it, and then you go in with a little bit of arrogance thinking, you know what, I've kicked this one, I've finished this one, and you go in with that little arrogance and you've misjudged your abilities on that course.
Sure, I'll jump into that one first, Jimmy, and I'll compare a 2005 Western States to a 2013. I trained much differently because I didn't have the time for my second one. But when I put that bib on, for whatever reason, I knew that I needed to be a bit conservative. I knew I couldn't really race this thing. But I put that bib on and my head went straight back to 2005.
You're the same athlete.
I was the same guy. And I was the same guy for 30 miles.
It's that, the last 70 that...
The last 70 was tough. Jimmy, how about you?
Yeah, Rio del Lago, 2017. We did a podcast only 45 minutes after I DNF'd that race. And Rio del Lago, the first time was, I think, 2009. I ran my first sub-20-hour 100-miler. I was third place overall. I came back to Rio del Lago in 2011. I ran faster than that, and I was second place overall. So I went into Rio wanting to run faster, knowing that I could do well there. And the day didn't go well from the outset. And, you know, 10 miles in, I'm already feeling like I felt at previous Rios, you know, 60, 70 miles in.
Wow.
And it got to me psychology-wise, like just the way that I thought about the race emotionally and mentally shifted, because I wanted to do better. And I was... It was a different. The funny thing is, it was a totally different course and vastly different weather. I ran the race in hot weather twice, and it was raining last year. So that definitely messed with my overall thought process. And I underestimated it, because I was like, hey, if I can run these times in a hot weather day, cold and rain, no problem. And that definitely came back to haunt me later in that day.
Hey, Jimmy, how important do you think it is to have a good coach as you're going into your A race to maybe temper some of those expectations and get your mind right for that?
I think that depends on the athlete, and it depends on the coach.
Okay,
like a romantic relationship or a business partnership, A good athlete and a good coach don't always have compatibility. As an athlete, you need to know, you know, what your strengths and weaknesses are, both physiologically, athletically, and mentally. And each coach offers something a little bit different, and finding the right match for you. I think that every athlete is better off with the right coach, mm-hmm. but it's not a universal... An athlete with a coach is better than an athlete without a coach. You're better as an athlete without a coach if it's not the right fit. If you have the right coach for you, you're always going to get more out of training and racing, because there's an accountability. There's someone who is not emotionally attached to your progress as an athlete, your result, that can objectively help you lay out training and adjust and lay out a race plan. So having a good coach is fantastic, but having the wrong coach is worse than going at it alone.
Good, good. Hey, Jimmy, I'm going to throw one in there next, because you can't have all the fun, and there's a good chance that some of my mistakes might overlap your mistakes, and I need to get one of them in there. And that is not having a reason to finish. All of these races are hard. You have to decide before you even show up how important it is for you to get done, because guaranteed somewhere in your marathon, 50K, 50 mile, 100 mile, whatever distance, there's going to be some adversity. And there's going to be a number of reasons why you want to quit, but your reason to finish has to be bigger than that reason to quit. And if you don't show up, if you're still searching for your why when you show up, you're in a pretty difficult spot. So I know that races, especially in the very beginning, my very first 100, I would have finished if I had to crawl on my knees, because that to me was what it meant to finish. So I expected that type of adversity and I was ready for it. But then after you do it a couple times, you realize you don't have to climb on your knees and get bloody. Yet they shouldn't end like that. So when things do come across, unless you have a reason deep inside to finish it, that there's a good chance that that argument might not go the way you want.
And I would say it's tough to come up with that reason midway through the race.
Oh, you don't want to come up then. You're in a poor negotiating spot. You're in a corner.
Yeah.
I call that the why muscle. it's one of those things where, you know, we usually have a compelling reason that brings us into the sport. There's not anybody going, oh, I'm just sitting around thinking like, I think I want to run 100 miles over a mountain range. But after you get a few of these under your belt, you know, your why changes. It changes race to race. It might even change mile to mile. So it's easier to adjust a why than it is to come up with a new one on the fly. And, you know, I found that very thing hit me at my Rio del Lago DNF a year ago. It was, you know, I was literally doing it because I think it's a waste to do 100 miler after all of the training and time and sacrifice that it takes to get ready for it. I've always thought, oh, you should do like two a season to capitalize on all the hard work to get into that kind of shape. And so I was throwing in a second 100 at the end of my season just because I didn't want to waste the fitness, whatever that means. And,
That's really interesting, Jimmy. That's actually really interesting.
When I started suffering early, there was no purpose for it. There was no reason. And I think had it been my only 100 of the season, my first 100, I didn't have my qualifiers out of the way. I think, you know, my why would have been stronger. And, you know, this Javelina for me in a couple of weeks is going to be my only, it's going to be my first race of any distance since Rio del Lago. Mm-hmm. We're going to be like 51 weeks later, almost a full year of no racing and very little training, quite frankly. but my why is a lot stronger. I have two continuity streaks on the line here. I have 10 consecutive years of a 100-mile or longer finish. And I have, it'll be my fifth year to qualify and put in for Western States, where I am 0-for-10 lifetime in the lottery. And I'm assuming that I will not get picked in the lottery, even if I qualify this year. So I'm kind of thinking of it towards next year. It's the difference between having one ticket and having 32 tickets.
You know, can we do some offshore betting on you getting in? Because I think we could raise some activity there. So I'm going to ask both of you this question. Would you find it better for your outcome, a remote mountain race that you really don't have any way out, or something local that you know the trail well, but heck, you know every convenience stop, and you even have an Uber at the ready if you needed it to get home in 10 minutes. Which race do you think would be most challenging for you?
The most challenging? I would jump in because I've had a DNF where I did have access to an Uber or a generous aid station worker that could take me back to my car.
Yeah.
And that's the one that I DNF'd versus one of the first 50Ks that I did way long time ago where I thought I was going to die. And I was out of water. I still had like 12 miles left to go. And I sat down and I thought, okay, I have to quit. I'm done. But I was thinking, how are they going to get me? They're going to have to send a horse down the trail after they realize I haven't finished. I'm going to have to spend the night here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what got me up and I started walking.
No way out.
So there was no way out. I just thought there's no way. I don't want to spend the night here.
Jimmy, remote mountain race or convenient around the house local trails?
The familiarity breeds contempt rule applies here. When you're in your, you know, backyard or in a place with easy access to quitting, you have more opportunities to drop out when you're feeling awful. The remote mountain race, especially in a point-to-point format, you get to an aid station feeling awful and you start talking to people about wanting to quit. And they're like, well, you can do that, but you're going to wait here for 14 hours till this aid station has to pack out.
Yeah.
And that
you wait
for an hour, even if you decide to drop out, you wait for 2 hours and you're 2 hours, you got 12 hours more to go. You feel better. Your calories are up. You get up and you walk to the next aid station thinking you're going to drop there and suddenly you feel great. So,
Never cut the band.
This is the thing. Javelina, you know, this is one of my main reasons. Getting too comfortable at the start and finish, because Javelina, you're going to be at the start and finish four times before you're done. And your family's there. Your friends are there. People are the start-finish line of Javelina is called Javelina Headquarters. And there might be 1,000 people there crewing, pacing, partying. They have a full on like aid station kitchen. It's a party. It's like Woodstock for ultra runners. And, you know, people are having a lot of fun and there's light and yeah, at night there's light. It might be cold and windy out in the desert and you're feeling awful and being there four times, you're going to feel awful at least one or two of those times. And you have to get up and drag yourself back out and go do another loop in the desert that's 19, 20 miles long. So,
you know,
having that option of an out multiple times is hard to overcome.
Both of you have done 100-mile races like Javelina, and yours was Headland Tundra, where you have to go through the start multiple times. When you're feeling that bad, how do you not quit and continue?
You have to have your mind made up before you're in the situation.
So before you get to that finish line, which you go to that line,
you go to that race knowing that is one of the major psychological obstacles of the race. You go in going, I need to set this up so I have a time limit to get in and out of the start and finish line area, and if I have something I need to troubleshoot, like maybe blisters, you have to go see the medical people, or some stomach thing you have to, you know, get under control. You're not going to stay there because you don't feel good. It's like, I have to get in and get out so I don't sit around thinking about it. It's kind of like cliff jumping. If you stand at the edge of the cliff looking at the lake below, the longer you stand at that cliff, the less likely you're going to jump.
Or maybe even, and correct me, because I've never done one of those kind of races, you just say, if I have to quit, that's not where I'm going to quit. I will go to the next aid station beyond.
Well, you do yourself a disservice by leaving yourself out.
Okay.
I am not dropping out of Javelina this year unless medical prevents me from leaving. Someone else has to tell me, you are going to do harm to yourself. We need to get you an IV or get you to the hospital or whatever. Like, I can't go, oh, I don't feel like it right now. I promise you at some point.
You don't feel like it.
At some point in this race, I'm not going to feel like it. Like, my average miles over the last 6-7 weeks has been like 30, 35 miles a week. My maximum training week was 46 miles. My maximum long run was 20 and a half miles. I did not do a single double of consequence. I'm going into this undertrained. I know it, but I have a big why. I'm a sentimental guy. I want my 11th consecutive year of continuity in 100 milers. I want to continue my ability to get denied by Western States over and over and over again.
You don't ruin that story.
Don't ruin that one. He don't want to ruin that negative.
And I'll go along with you, Jimmy. Deciding to leave that aid station is already a done deal, no matter how you feel. And the great thing about aid stations, they pump you up. hey, Scott, you look great. You look fantastic, you know, and eat some of this. And
they're good liars.
And the other good news is you only have to worry about it three times because the first time out, it's pretty simple.
Yeah, yeah.
The leave is easy.
You know, I'll give Javelina people another reason to leave headquarters. When the sun goes down, the group that takes over Jackass Junction, which is the main aid station that's not the start-finish area, my buddy Justin Luktik is the aid captain out there for the overnight, and it is an absolute shit show. It is everybody gets kind of a little drunk, and they play like really loud music in the middle of the desert that you can hear from about a mile and a half, 2 miles away, and it is a party. Like, if you're gonna go feel bad somewhere, go feel bad there because it's not gonna last. And Justin, for those of you that have not been to this race, is a shaved head, beautiful man from Brooklyn, and he's got a thick Brooklyn accent. And the more he drinks, the more Brooklyn he gets. And listen, you want to go find the disco ball and find Justin and dance your ass off for a couple minutes, even if your legs are aching, because really, this is one of the events that's just, it's a party on dirt. And I'm going out there because I know that, you know, I can manage my way through 100 and have something to look forward to constantly. Halfway through the loop, I'm going to get Jackass Junction. Halfway through the loop, I'm going to be at the start finish and see, you know, other coyotes. My wife and kids are coming to this race. So my daughter Bardot and Pierce and my wife Kate will all be at the aid station most of the time until the kids' bedtime. But I'm excited. Like, you need to have something to look forward to. And Rio's the same way. Rio's got unbelievable groups of people at every aid station. I remember that being the biggest letdown for me was not continuing because I saw so many friends and encouraging people at every aid station that were just, you know, like, how you doing? You look great. Keep it going, you know, and let those aid stations build you up, but don't stay there too long.
So far we have,
we're 27 minutes in and we've done one.
Two. We've done two.
We've done two. Oh, okay.
Yeah. You don't respect the distance.
You don't respect the time, the podcast time.
And you didn't have a reason or a why.
Oh, that's
so
right. I'm sorry.
If you're scoring at home, those are the two categories. Jimmy, you're up.
Speed. Getting carried away with race splits too early in the race. This is definitely an issue at both Javelina and Rio, but you can throw your legs under the bus at Western States. You know, any race, you can get caught up in the momentum of being around so many people and either worrying too much about your pace per mile or falling into somebody else's race plan because someone is there that you know and you think you should run as fast or faster than them. Really, you know, the people that are best served are people that have a solid knowledge of their heart rate and keep it below a certain threshold. But at the end of the day, it's managing effort and staying conservative. I usually give myself an effort ceiling for the first 50K, for the first third of the race, because by the time I get 30, 35 miles into 100, I'm too tired to run hard enough to hurt myself.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, that, say that again. That is a great statement.
So I really focus on being conservative and keeping the effort lower than and the speed lower than I want for the first 30 to 35 miles of a 100 miler. Because by the time I get to the 50K mark or thereabout, sometimes even the marathon mark, I have too much fatigue and I'm too tired to run hard enough to hurt myself.
I noticed that with my heart rate. I need heart rate monitor to that point you're talking about, 30, 40 miles. I can monitor and manage, and I can manipulate. I can drive it high. I can keep it low. But once I get to that point, Jimmy, where fatigue is my running partner, I cannot increase that heart rate. It's just there. This is all I got. The pedal is to the metal, and 140 is as high as this thing goes anymore. So,
yeah, this particular rule that I'm going to throw out there doesn't necessarily apply to Javelina and Rio because there aren't a lot of long, steep climbs early in the race. But I have a rule to hike every hill for the first 30 miles in 100. And then from that point forward, if I feel like I have the energy to run up the hill, I'm good, because I'm already too tired to run myself into trouble. So at Javelina and Rio, you know, Rio has what, like 15, 20 miles of bike path in the first 20 miles of the race?
Yeah, depends which course they pick that year. We have a few different ones because of permits and things. But yeah, there's been years
this,
where
this year, it's early on. Yeah.
Well, yeah. You know, in years that I've run it, 30 miles of bike path.
Yeah,
around
and it's right up front. It's in the front part of the race. Yeah. And Javelina, the joke at Javelina is you're doing the same, you know, Pemberton Trail loop on every lap, and you reverse directions. But I would guesstimate that the average grade of the Pemberton Trail from the starting line to the halfway point on the loop is about 2%. And the joke at Javelina is you got 2% up for the first half of the first loop, and then 2% down on the way back. And the second loop, it's 4% up and 4% down. And the third loop, it's 6% up and 6% down.
That's pretty
and
accurate.
The fourth loop, it's 8% up and 8% down. And then the final lap, it's 15%. Like, how does it get steeper every lap? Well, you have to stay conservative to have that effort feel consistent. And you know, it takes most ultra runners 15, 20 miles to kind of get their legs under them at the beginning of these long races anyway. So, you know, it's like really, really reel yourself in that first lap at Javelina, that first 30 miles at Rio.
Jimmy, I was going to, that was my exact next one that I had on my list. So I'm just going to pile on and then let you move on, because I know you have more than I do. I put down racing to your bunk, because that's what people are doing when they start out too fast. They're just racing to see how quick they can get to that spot that they blow up, because that's inevitably going to happen.
Is that because you're looking forward to it? You know it's going to happen, so let's get it out of the way?
No, it's just inevitably what happens when you go out too hard. You're just racing to your own bunk. So does the bonk come first, or does the finish line? More than likely, if you're starting out beyond your capability, it's the bonk you're going to see before the finish. That's almost a guarantee. So racing to your bonk is what I titled that one. Jimmy, what's your next one?
I have one after Jimmy. I actually thought of one.
Go ahead.
No, Jimmy, jump.
We're ready.
I was just going to say mine is kind of silly, and it's probably...
we'll decide that.
And it's probably pretty obvious, but... not being in shape for the race, physically in shape. You know, when I was preparing for a race that I DNF'd, I had gone out there and I proved to myself, you know, you have these milestones that you can say, okay, for this race, if it's a 50K, if I can run, you know, 15 miles on my long run or 20 miles on my long run, I'm good to go. And I met those milestones, but I didn't have the overall base. And so I ended up cramping. I didn't have that that fitness, and so the cramping took me out of the race.
You can't cheat preparation.
You have to be in shape for the race.
I am attempting to cheat preparation in 2 weeks.
Well, it also comes with arrogance, and I think that's where you've checked yourself, Jimmy. If you're going in there thinking, I'm ready, I'm in shape for this, that's the mistake. You're going in knowing that you're underprepared, and you're going to be careful with your execution.
I know that I am prepared to do 100 miles over 14 days. I am about to find out if I can squeeze the 2 weeks into 30 hours.
Are they prepared for you to be out there 14?
We will soon see.
There is a time limit, isn't there, Jimmy? Have you prepared for the time limit to time out?
Unfortunately, yes. I'm going to just keep going until they tell me to get the heck off their course.
That's like 14 miles a day.
All right, Jimmy, you're up.
All right. So one of the mistakes that I've made in a couple of races is mismanaging caffeine and naps. Ooh. So... this one applies a little bit more to Javelina than it does to Rio, but there's one principle that will apply to both. It's inevitable if you are running overnight if you're running past the time that you would normally go to sleep, that you are going to get sleepy. Not to mention, you know, we're all getting up earlier than most of us do on a normal day. I'd say 95% of the people in this these races don't normally get up at 3:30 a.m. There are those exceptions, but we're getting up early, so we're going to be a little bit tired, even if we're, you know, got a lot of adrenaline going. And we're going to get into these events, and, you know, we have sports nutrition, gels, bars, those kinds of things that have caffeine in them. A lot of us are coffee drinkers. There's products along the course like Coke, Mountain Dew, other things that have caffeine in them. And so as it applies to Javelina, caffeine and heat do not mix well. I won't dive fully into the science behind that because it would just make this a whole other sidebar podcast. But basically, you can really get an upset stomach from doing caffeine in the middle of a 85, 95, 100-plus degree day. And Javelina is exposed, so the heat's going to play higher than what the forecast says. If it says 85, it's going to play more like 95. If it's 95, it's going to play so on and so forth. But the other piece of this is caffeine can give you a boost of energy, but it can also fall off a cliff. So once you start caffeine, you have to keep it going. And I think of Western States in 2009 and Angeles Crest 1 year. Deep in the race, I had the caffeine going, but I didn't plan for a really long stretch in between aid stations, and I didn't have caffeine on me. So I was kind of like pounding some Coke through the night at the aid stations. But then in between the aid stations, I was getting really sleepy and tired and dragging. You know, my pace would fall to like 25 minutes a mile, and I just couldn't keep my eyes open. And that's the time where you start thinking about, well, if I just laid down here on the side of the trail or get to a remote aid station, you're like, I'm just going to lay down in the cot and sleep for a minute. And it's dangerous. It's Russian roulette with your race. So on the caffeine, save it. If you can do without caffeine for a week leading into your race, I feel like you'll have a truer sense of if you're getting enough rest at night and sleeping, getting as much sleep as you can the week of a race. Now this doesn't work for everybody. I've got two young kids, and unfortunately my sleep race week and even the night before the race is going to be at the mercy of a 3.5-year-old girl and a 15-month-old boy. But the more you can kind of work on getting a good full night of sleep, whatever it is that you personally need, for the last, you know, 7 to 14 days leading into your event, the better off you're going to be dealing with sleep deprivation as you run through the night. Save the caffeine until you get sleepy, until you get tired, and start to use it and then continue to use it. You got to get something in every 25, 30 minutes, a little bit at a time to kind of keep that energy up. And that doesn't mean that you're not going to battle with the sleep demons. It doesn't mean that it's going to go well for you. But it should go better than it would have otherwise. States specifically in 2009, I was really right on the cusp of the 24-hour, and I was battling, and I had been battling since Forest Hill.
Mile 62.
Somewhere between Brown's Bar and 49, I was like literally falling asleep on the trail. Didn't manage the caffeine right, and my pace fell off a cliff. And in 2009, I was the second bronze buckle. So 24 hours and some change. And I'm not saying that if I had managed my caffeine well, that I would have cut 28 minutes off in the last, you know, 10 miles. But it certainly was possible.
Yep. You know, you've experimented, Mr. Freeman, Mr. Don Freeman, mm-hmm. with caffeine pills.
Right.
I don't know if I've ever asked you how that worked.
when you're taking them, they work great. But there is no free lunch, like Jimmy just said. You gain from something, you're going to answer for it later. Drop. So you've got to keep that in mind. I think we've talked about it on this podcast, the half-life of caffeine is 6 hours, whatever that means. You're going to get a bump for a period of time. It goes up and then slowly drifts off. So in my long races, the multi-day stuff, I really kept in mind that this is going to help me for six if I plan on sleeping or resting coming up to manage that caffeine pill appropriately so I'm not 2 hours in and trying to sleep. So yeah. There is no free lunch. Jimmy's right. And if it's with a 24-hour or 30-hour race, you get one shot. You know, you're not going to have a lot of sleeping time in there. So make sure you have enough to keep it going or use it sparingly at the end. So good point, Jimmy. I've got my next one. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
It's called Taper Means Taper. Mm. And that's just not decreasing.
Is that a Mark Twain quote?
It may have been. It was either him or Abraham Lincoln, some one of those guys. And taper means taper because we all know to decrease our running and maybe decrease our mileage and the cross-train stuff. But taper means not only sleeping a bit more, but tapering the rest of your life too. It doesn't mean jam as much work. I'm going to be gone for a few days. I got to travel. I'm going to travel back. I'm going to get more and more work done. You can really sabotage yourself and not even have your shoes on. You can sabotage yourself before you even get there because you put more work into your non-running time and really packing it in other places. Taper means taper.
And I think jet lag kind of falls in that same category too. You got to prepare for that and be aware that there could be some issues there.
Yeah. Taper means taper, Jimmy. What's that mean to you?
Well, specifically, it means no big runs 14 days out from the event.
Okay. Yeah. Then,
I know a lot of ultra runners that try and squeeze in a 6-hour run, 50K run a couple weekends before their big event. And these are people without tremendous volume behind them to begin with. So I got my last long run last week. It was only 4 hours long. It was only 20 miles and some change. There's one part of my brain that's like, well, if I just build it one more time, but it's going to take you 3 weeks to recover from something. It's going to take you 3 weeks to assimilate that fitness for most workouts. And I'm going to get a decently long run in this weekend, but not the longest that I've run. It's going to be tapering off from what I've done.
I think that's something we need to keep in mind. I think it was Tim Tollefson that we talked to about this. And he brought it up that it does take the 3 weeks to benefit from your last workout, which also means that it takes about 3 weeks for you to start losing some of your fitness. So there's a grace period in there that you really can't add and you really don't subtract. So go ahead and taper, relax, kick back, put your feet up, and get ready, get healthy, and get energized for this run coming up. So I think people get too hung up on one more 6-hour run 2 weeks before, and that's just wearing yourself out before you start the race.
There's no benefit.
No benefit. Okay, Jimmy, what you got?
Going back to my cheat sheet here.
We're up to seven, by the way. If you're keeping score,
I'm 7 for 7. By
you're
the way,
you're 7 for 7. Yeah.
How about you, Scott?
I haven't been keeping score.
Well, let me help you. You're seven.
I'm
seven for seven.
Okay,
and I bet you most of the people out there are 7 for 7. We've got a lot of experts. Jimmy, what's the next one? See if we qualify.
Not managing the conditions in for these two races, the heat and or the cold. So heat is interesting because you can only take off so many clothes before they arrest me. people who do heat prep for a hot race sometimes get into a race like Javelina and think, I've done my sauna sessions. I've run in hot conditions. I'm good. And then on race day, they don't, put a little ice around their neck or spray themselves with a cold, water bottle, keeping their head and the back of their neck wet. In the cold sense, I wasn't prepped for rain, cold, and wind at Rio last year. I just simply don't have the gear. doesn't rain in LA. So, you know, that weather condition took me off my game. It's not that you're going to be comfortable in a 100-miler, but you don't want to make it more uncomfortable than it has to be. So you have to manage the conditions. Actually, another Rio, I mismanaged it where I was managing the heat and wearing some ice around my neck, and it got to be evening and I was like, oh, it's, you know, 20, 30 degrees cooler right now. I can stop managing this. And that's when I overheated and started throwing up. So, you know, you got to kind of stay on top of the conditions and make sure that you're doing everything in your power on race day, real time, to stay on top of those conditions.
And with the packs now, you know, with the hydration packs, there's ample room back there to shove a jacket, to put a set of arm sleeves, maybe a set of gloves, things to make a buff, things to make you comfortable out there. This sport's hard enough, let alone setting yourself up for a little extra suffrage. You don't need it. It's going to be there waiting for you. You don't have to increase this level of difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
Did you fall asleep there, Scott?
No, that was good. I was just thinking, I actually came up with one.
Oh, good.
So I can have some skin in the game here.
Let's do it. Are
we moving on?
Yes.
Having good expectations, or correct expectations. You always go into the race
optimistic.
Optimistic. This is my race plan. This is the way things are going. And if you don't have the expectation that things are going to fall apart, I think you can jeopardize your finish. If you go in there and think that you're going to be at a certain pace and you don't hit those splits, you can start feeling negative. If you go in there thinking, I never get blisters, and all of a sudden you have a blister, it's an easy out. So you need to go in knowing that your race plan is going to fall apart. If you go in there thinking, this is my race plan and I'm going to execute, that can sabotage your race.
Spreadsheet people can be in trouble, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
You got to be flexible.
Yeah. If you go in there and know that you have a left sock and a right sock, and I remember a race where I went in and I had all of my good stuff at mile 25, which was a 50-mile race, and I was just looking forward to that drop bag, and I got there and it wasn't there.
Oh.
And I didn't have a crew, I didn't have a pacer, and I sat down and I just thought, I'm done. And I could have easily DNF'd right there. And I thought, you know what, this is what ultra running is all about, is managing poor decisions or managing
adversity.
And I thought, okay, so I don't have my favorite drink. So I don't have an extra pair of socks or whatever. And so I got up and I walked.
Ran.
So
it's
no,
a story.
At that point,
it was a walk.
At that point, I was walking because I was still feeling pretty upset with myself. I found out later that I didn't put my drop bag in the right pile. I put it in the wrong pile, so it never made it.
It was waiting for you when you got back.
It was there,
Jimmy.
Don has some experience with putting drop bags in the wrong pile.
Oh, you know,
or putting his rental car in the wrong at the wrong end of the race.
Yeah, you know, it told before, but Jimmy, I still owe you a great deal of gratitude for rescuing me all the way through Angeles Crest that year, I think 2012, 11 or something.
I had nothing to do with it. That was all Kate Martini Freeman.
You know, I read the year before's manual, so I was great. I was set for the year prior. Unfortunately,
I have something.
What?
Oh, sorry, Don. Go ahead.
They changed everything the year I ran it, which was a bit unsettling as I showed up unprepared at each of my aid stations, especially the light that I left behind. So, Jimmy, go ahead.
This is to address Scott's point. I read something of Anne Trason's years back, and she had a way of framing the mentality that I really loved and I've used ever since. And that was, this isn't going to be a perfect quote or paraphrase, but to this point, she said she looks at a race like a six-problem puzzle, and that if you kind of figure out all the things that could go wrong in a race and you work on, you know, being able to anticipate things you may experience, three of your problems are going to come out of that list, out of the probable likely list. So, you know, going into Javelina, I know that it's possible that I'll deal with some heat issues. I did when I finished there 2 years ago. I had some stomach problems related to overheating. I know that I'll probably have trouble running a high percentage of the race in the second half because you run so much of it in the first half. That's probably that's a probable thing that could come up. Well, there are going to be three things that come up from the unexpected, unanticipated, out of left field category. Now, I can give you a list of things that have happened for me that I didn't anticipate, but when those things happen to me at a future race, I'm more likely to put that in the probable list. So as an example, you're on your way to the race and you get a flat tire. That would be unanticipated. You kind of don't think about that in your race planning. Making a wrong turn on the course, you know, first couple of times that happens, you're not thinking about that as the things that might go wrong. You're like, I'm going to follow the course markings. I know some of these trails, I'll be fine. Or I've done this race before, I got it. So that can fall into the unanticipated list. But the mentality here is realizing that you're going to have three things that are going to come up that you're going to be like, I know what to do. I know how to deal with this. And you're going to have three things come up that are going to be, they're going to catch you totally off guard. And if you can relate to these six things, like they're part of the puzzle that is finishing a 100-mile race, your mentality will be like, okay, all right, here's one of those unexpected things. Let's do this. I can figure this out. And it becomes more of a game, and I'm not going to call it fun at that point, but you can kind of get yourself mentally back on track quicker, because how well a race goes or whether you finish or not, a lot of times is a function of how little time you spend throwing a tantrum about what didn't go right.
Yeah, how much energy do you spend on race day complaining to yourself and getting angry with the circumstances? That energy should be placed in moving forward, not thinking about what's behind you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, here's my last one. We're about out of time.
We're with nine, so this will round it out with 10.
Jimmy, do you want your 10th one on here? Do you want me to throw this... this last one I have scribbled on here, knowing that it was my last one, which probably wasn't my best one because it came at the end of my life.
Are you telling me your last one sucks, Don?
I came out stronger than I finished, much like an endurance race where you kind of just hobble across the line. I submit.
Okay. Well, I'll say a reason that I've DNF'd in the past that we haven't totally covered is I've had a bad attitude.
No, I think of you as the opposite, though, Jimmy. I see you coming in smiling, high-fiving people, you know, circling back to high-five a 12-year-old along the side with a sign. That's how I've seen you.
There's two pieces to that, right?
Two Jimmys.
The one piece of that is fake it till you make it. And the other piece to that is I learned from having a bad attitude at other races that when you're in duress, when other people see you not doing well, it's human nature to feel a little bad for you or want to coddle you a little bit to help you. It's a human nature trait that when people see you struggling, there's a part of them that sympathizes or empathizes, and they that takes their energy to that place. And I learned that if I come into an aid station and I give the volunteers some good energy and I find some kids to high five and I say hi to people that I like or people that I like for being there and I just make some noise, I hoot and holler like a coyote and I high five some people, it elevates their energy and that's the energy that I get back. So I'm high fiving and going woohoo. Very few volunteers don't high five you back and cheer for you. So my attitude at an aid station, when I have a good attitude, is to thank the volunteers because that gracious energy comes back at you. It's to find the little kid who's bored out of his mind because he's standing alongside a dirty trail waiting for his parent. You know, to high five that kid, acknowledge that he's there. I think the race that I knocked the attitude piece out of the park, and there were other factors that helped me really find some solid footing here, but the 2014 Western States 100 was the middle of the summer that I attempted the original 600 challenge, the original six in 13 weeks. Western States was race number two. It was my second opportunity to start Western States. It was the third time I was in the race field. My wife was pregnant with our now oldest daughter, Bardot, and I knew that my opportunity to spend an entire summer traveling around the country doing 100 milers was going to be the final time that I was going to get to do that in the way that I did that summer. And throughout the race, I remember I just felt grateful to be there. I felt privileged and excited. And even when I was suffering, I came into the aid stations and, you know, I encouraged the other runners in the race. I, you know, high-fived other crews. I just did things that had other people giving me that energy back. And while I had some physical difficulties in that race, I had zero mental low points. And wow. It was fully a function of that I didn't invest in my emotions in how I physically felt. If I felt physically bad, I didn't make it a pity party as well. And I certainly haven't had that great attitude for 100% of every race. I throw my tantrums out in the middle of the desert or the mountain. I feel sorry for myself when the race isn't going my way sometimes. It's all normal human stuff, but what do you do with it? And at Javelina this year, I am planning to have a fantastic attitude. I'm planning to be grateful for the volunteers that are out there, for the other people that I'm running with that are sharing that experience with me. And that sort of grateful mindset, that positive attitude of giving people good energy so I get good energy back, makes a huge difference.
And I think we talked about this a bit when we were reviewing Alex Hutchinson's book about athletes that they were testing on treadmills or doing different things and having them smile or seeing pictures of people smile. They just, their performance improved or their perception of level of difficulty decreased when they were around positive faces and positive attitude. So I think it's been proven more than just on your shoes, Jimmy. I think it's well known out there, and keep practicing it. That's good stuff. Well, I think I scored a perfect expert on doing things wrong out there.
You got straight A on that
straight
one, huh?
Straight
A. Hey, Jimmy, I have a question for you. What's your costume for Javelina this year?
My costume is that of a severely undertrained runner.
a bathrobe and some slippers?
Well, Javelina is interesting because I'd say about 20% of the race dresses up in actual costumes, and I'm bringing my family out, and they may or may not be dressed in some things. And with kids, I really look forward to Halloween, and my wife is big into it as well. I will be wearing clothes that help me feel comfortable while in high heat and running through a desert for an extended period of time. But I will be decking out on October 31st with my kids and my wife. We're doing a full family Despicable Me Minions theme.
Very good. We'll go down to Southern California, knock on doors until we see that whole family dressed as Minions down there. It's Minions. That's what they are, right, Scott?
They're Minions. Yeah,
that's what you're free to call me out on it.
No, I didn't watch
the movie.
I wouldn't call you out on it. I'm not that kind of guy.
And Jimmy, we wish you very, very well on your 14-day expedition in the desert there.
Yeah. How many miles can I get done before the flight? That's kind of the game.
Yeah, we wish you luck, and we hope that you learn something from this. If you think that there's another way that you can sabotage your A race, go ahead and leave it in the comments. We'd be interested to see if there's other ones out there. I'm sure there is.
Oh, there's plenty.
We'd also like to know what your score is. Let's see if anybody flunked this test.
If you didn't do any of them at all, then you flunked them. Is that what you're telling
yeah.
me?
Yeah. You DNF'd.
If you got less than 5 of the 10, then you're a failure at failing.
You need to race more.
Go sign up more and make more mistakes so you can join the rest of us up here at 7 out of 7.
And if you are running Javelina, make sure to high five me on the loop when we cross paths, and so I can cheer for and encourage you back, and good luck at Rio if you're doing that one.
We'll be out there.
I need to keep my 0-for Western States streak going, so I'm hoping that at least 4,000 people are applying for those 250 lottery slots. So I want everyone who's dreaming of Western States to get their name in the hat at Javelina and Rio.
Well, very good. With that said, go out and make more mistakes.
Mas.
All right, Jimmy. Thank you.
That's well done.
Thanks, fellas.
Good to talk to you.
Yeah, it's always good to catch up, guys. I figured this one would be a few races out there.
We need to mention where they can go to get him for a coach.
Oh.
Let's do that real quick.
We're still recording. So, Jimmy.
Oh, we are.
Yeah, we've stopped recording.
You didn't hit the red button.
It takes a lot of work.
Edit-free podcast.
Obviously, Jimmy has a lot of wisdom here, and he puts himself out there as a coach. Jimmy, how do they find you as a coach?
But if you're in Southern California, we are actually executing our first group training program in 2 years. So the SoCal Coyotes are doing a weekend and Tuesday night training program to help people get ready for races.
The Coyotes have been reintroduced into the wild?
Reimagined. And that's SoCalCoyotes.com.
Got it.
I am also a one-on-one coach with a very small stable of individual clients that live all over the country. Uh-huh. And for those of you that are interested in finding out more about that, you can just drop me an email at coachjimmydean@gmail.com.
Perfect.
You can reference this podcast and we'll give you a preferential treatment. But if you forget the email, you can just check out SoCalCoyotes.com. We have a contact form on the website as well.
Perfect. Thank you, Jimmy. We appreciate your wisdom. We appreciate your Mark Twain quotes. We never get enough Mark Twain quotes on this podcast. Well,
People talk about John Muir. They didn't realize Mark Twain was one heck of a trail runner.
He had the mustache for it, absolutely.
Oh, for sure. He was very hipster before they even knew what hipster was.
Yeah. All right, Jimmy, thanks for joining us. We'll find out how you did after the race.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
All right. Thank you. Bye.